For the sake of time, I'm going to go ahead and jump straight in here. Evolution is taught as fact in schools, in universities, in textbooks, and articles, and the media. And the evidence that is given in texts and articles attempting to prove evolution is on the screen. For any theory to be able to even claim to be scientific or rational, it has to have evidence, it has to have scientific evidence in support of it. Now, in our last session, we looked at several of these alleged evidences of evolution, ending with an in-depth look at the alleged fossil evidence for human evolution. We looked at several of these fossils on the screen, the bulk of what actually comprises the evolutionist alleged evidence from the fossil record. And as I said last time, we have materials on our website and at Apologetics Press that examine what's left on the screen that we didn't have time to get into, and it's ultimately more of the same. Not one fossil has been found which unequivocally can be used as conclusive evidence of the theory of evolution, although there should be billions of these transitional fossils. The missing links between the alleged ape-like ancestor and human beings, they're not available. No wonder in their more candid moments, the top evolutionists will admit this. Colin Patterson was the paleontologist that served as the editor of the professional journal published by the British Museum of Natural History in London. He wrote a book, literally the textbook, on evolution, and an individual wrote in to him and said, how come you didn't mention anything about transitional fossils? And he said in response, "I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any, fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. Yet Gould and the American Museum people are hard to contradict when they say there are no transitional fossils. I'll lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument." That's quite an admission. According to Colin Patterson, there are no conclusive transitional fossils. Not one fossil that can be used to conclusively prove a link between humans and their alleged ape-like ancestors. We looked at several examples that a lot of people will try to use yesterday. Wouldn't it be nice if all evolutionists would recognize this and make that admission, and then scrap their bias against the obvious rational option that they've thrown off the table, and that is that evolution is false. The creation model actually is supported by the evidence. Kate Wong, evolutionist and science writer for Scientific American, she said, "For decades, paleoanthropologists have combed remote corners of Africa on hand and knee for fossils of Homo's earliest representatives. Their efforts have brought only modest gains, a jawbone here, a handful of teeth there. Most of the recovered fossils instead belong to either ancestral Australopithecines or later members of Homo, creatures too advanced to illuminate the order in which our distinctive traits arose. With so little to go on, the origin of our genus has remained as mysterious as ever." So the evolutionists themselves admit they don't have much to even try to work with, to even try to claim could be evidence in order to prove the evolutionary lineage of humans. There's this notable gap in the fossil record hooking the Australopithecines, so essentially apes, with the advanced genus Homo. Lord Solly Zuckerman is a famous zoologist and anatomist and British scientific advisor, as well as professor at Oxford University in the past. And after studying the Australopithecines for over 15 years, he admitted years ago, "If man did descend from an ape-like ancestor, he did so without leaving any fossil traces of the steps of that transformation." And as we saw yesterday, that is certainly still the case. Lee Berger, paleoanthropologist and discoverer of the Australopithecus sediba fossils that have taken the front stage in the media a lot over the last 2 or 3 years, he admitted that the fossil record is inadequate in showing the evolution of humans. He said, "We really need a better record, and it's out there." That's wishful thinking. Remember, I quoted yesterday Charles Darwin, who had a similar mindset as Berger's way back in the 1800s. He admitted the fossil record is in contrast to his theory, and he hoped future exploration and research into the fossil record would help substantiate his theory. And guess what? It's been over 150 years. 150 years of extra digging, and yet still his theory, it's out there somewhere. The evidence is somewhere out there. Evolutionary zoologist of Oxford University, Mark Ridley, he said, "No real evolutionist, whether gradualistic or punctuationist, uses the fossil record as evidence in favor of the theory of evolution as opposed to special creation. Exactly. The fossil record does not support evolution, although it should if evolution were true. Now notice from these quotes, many evolutionists have come around to conceding that they don't see proof of evolution in the fossil record. Okay, so why not give it up? Well, we'll talk about some of that in our next session. They're firmly committed to a naturalistic explanation of our origin. No God allowed, regardless of the evidence. That's considered ancient and mystic fable kind of stuff, and we just won't accept that. If there's no evidence for gradual Darwinian evolution, maybe it just happens really fast in spurts. Interpunctuated equilibrium. Ridley mentions punctuationists. This is a new growing trend in evolutionary circles. These are evolutionists who have ultimately admitted the fossil record doesn't substantiate gradual evolution of man from any kind of creature, from simple organisms. So instead of just throwing the theory of evolution out and accepting supernatural creation, atheistic scientists are suggesting maybe evolution happens in spurts, not gradually. This is known as punctuated equilibrium. I call it magical equilibrium because that's exactly what it amounts to. It's witchcraft. According to this theory, long periods of time will go by without much evolutionary change, with just microevolution happening. And as I've said this weekend, we don't have a problem with microevolution. That's in harmony with the evidence. The creationist doesn't have a problem with that. But then according to punctuated equilibrium, all of a sudden this flurry of major evolutionary change supposedly happens really fast, and changes which happen so fast that there's no proof of it in the fossil record. The problem with this idea is at least threefold. Number one, the theory admits that there is no empirical evidence that such a thing could happen. It's just a wild assertion based on the assumption that evolution had to happen and there is no God. Because remember, if there is no God, some form of evolution has to be true. If naturalism is true, it's got to happen. Evolution has got to happen, and so you can just kind of make up whatever you want because something's bound to be right the minute you take God off the table. But it's just a wild assertion based on this assumption, a frantic attempt to prop up this failed theory, a last-ditch effort to brush the creation model aside. There's never been such an evolutionary process witnessed. So according to the evolutionist's own definition of science, punctuated equilibrium is unscientific. You could just as easily claim fairies exist and float around inside of my eyeballs. I can say that. I can assert that, right? Don't I need some evidence for that before we would say that that is true? A second problem for the evolutionists with this theory is that it actually admits that evolutionists are backed into a corner in their lack of evidence from the fossil record to substantiate Darwinian evolution. So the goal has now become to just ignore that lack of evidence and just wildly speculate that superfast evolution happens. Thirdly, it concedes that the geologic record actually supports what we've long contended should be the case, what we would predict if creation is true. It admits that the creationist viewpoint has been in harmony with the scientific evidence all along. The evidence indicates that creature kinds have remained constant since creation, with only small variations coming into existence over time, what we call diversification, with strict narrow boundaries, boundaries defined by natural selection and sometimes by genetic mutations. Remembering that genetic mutations don't allow the addition of new information into the genome. We talked about that last night. So when fossils appear in the geologic strata, they're fully formed, distinct, functional species, not transitional creatures evolving across phylogenetic boundaries. That's what the creation model predicts. That's precisely what the geologic column reveals. Evolutionists call this explosion of fully functional species in the geologic column the Cambrian explosion, and they have difficulty dealing with it. Consider the words of famous evolutionary biologist of Oxford, Richard Dawkins. He said, "The Cambrian strata of rocks, vintage about 600 million years, evolutionists are now dating the beginning of the Cambrian at about 530 million years, are the oldest in which we find most of the major invertebrate groups. And we find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution the very first time they appear. It's as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history." Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists. Because that's what we'd predict. That's exactly what we would say should be the case. You know, as I said last night, the evolutionists say, "Creation, you guys aren't scientific. your model can't make predictions. That's hogwash. That's not true. We predict that that would be the case in the fossil record, and that's what is substantiated. The Cambrian explosion is proof positive of the creation model, and it's a problem for the evolutionary model. Atheistic evolutionist Blair Scott, communications director of American Atheists Incorporated, he said several months ago in this Butt Scott debate concerning the Earth, he said, now if I take the Cambrian explosion on its own, the logical conclusion I would draw is, wow, it was created. Quite an admission. But he goes on to say, the problem is that there's all this other evidence around it that creationists ignore, really. What evidence do you think he's talking about that we supposedly ignore? Well, wouldn't it be the evidences that are put in the textbooks, which we've been looking at all weekend? We don't ignore that. The evidence doesn't support evolution. So what happens the minute you show that that evidence, that alleged evidence, is not actually evidence for evolution? Once you get rid of all this other evidence, then isn't the logical conclusion wow, it was created? Yeah. Yeah, based on what Blair Scott says, yeah, I think that makes sense. So we've seen that evolution's evidence is actually woefully lacking, and so we looked at these last night. Now, what about dating methods, though? This is a big one. What about dating methods? According to evolutionists, the scientific techniques that are used to date materials are solid proof of an old Earth and an old universe, a contention that's in harmony with evolutionary theory and that's opposed to the creation model. So is that true? Do dating methods prove the Bible and support evolutionary theory or the old age idea? The problems with evolutionary dating methods are the assumptions upon which they are based. Any method is only as good as its assumptions. Scientists and mathematicians have to use assumptions all the time in order to be able to solve problems and figure things out. Assumptions can be fine and good to that end. I don't have a problem with assumptions. As long as the assumptions are reasonable and have a small enough effect on the outcome of the problem so as to not drastically affect or not drastically be affected by the assumptions. Let's take an example from the engineering world, a real-world scenario. Let's say I wanted to design a vehicle that would be for use on a one-mile strip of road that absolutely nobody uses. And it's been blocked off, and I've maintained the road well, and I've repaved it wherever necessary, and I've put up fences to keep animals out of that road. I've taken everything into account to make sure this road is clear and smooth, and it's just a one-mile strip. Now, let's say I wanted to design that car so that I could remotely control it from this building. And we're doing that in the engineering world. And so I've equipped it with the necessary sensors so I can determine its velocity and its heading at all time. And so I start developing the equations that are going to describe the motion of this vehicle using those sensor readings. And those equations are critical in order for me to know that I'm making the car do what I think I'm making it do, because I'm not going to put a camera on there. I'm not going to be able to see what's going on. Now, in order to make my equation simpler, I decide I'm going to make an assumption. I'm going to assume that the vehicle will always have 100% traction. It's never going to slide around or skid. Okay, and so I check the weather report, and I see that skidding conditions are unlikely. And it's, again, it's just a one-mile strip of road. That assumption would probably be a reasonable assumption. It's not going to cause a significant error in my calculations. There may be a few rocks in the road that'll cause this very small amount of error. But by the end of that one-mile strip of road, I can guarantee with a high degree of accuracy that that car will likely still be on the road. Now, let's say I design the same car with the same assumptions for off-road use out in the middle of nowhere with no road, and I want to control that car from here. And I assume there's 100% traction, no skidding, no sliding around. Now, how likely is it that I'm going to know exactly where my car is at the end of 1 mile of driving on that kind of terrain? It's very unlikely. Now, assumptions have to be made in science, but those assumptions have to be made very carefully, or the end results will be way off. Invalid assumptions could cause you to draw conclusions that are totally not in harmony with the actual evidence. Now, the problem is that evolutionary dating techniques are based on unreasonable assumptions. For example, uniformitarianism, fundamental assumption of evolutionary theory and its dating techniques. Ever since James Hutton suggested this idea that the present is the key to the past, this catchphrase, when examining geologic features. The McGraw-Hill Dictionary of Scientific and Technical Terms says Uniformitarianism is the concept that the present is the key to the past, the principle that contemporary geologic processes have occurred in the same regular manner and with essentially the same intensity throughout geologic time, and that events of the geologic past can be explained by phenomena observable today. So notice, this rules out any kind of major catastrophic event that we've never witnessed. So processes going on today are the same as they have always been throughout history. Now, without that assumption in place, dating the Earth would be impossible. Uniformitarianism is a fundamental assumption in evolutionary dating techniques. The question is it a reasonable assumption in dating the Earth? Can we really use that? Is uniformitarianism a reasonable assumption? Geologists say that water from 41% of the nation drains into the Mississippi River Delta. As the Mississippi River rolls on down towards the Gulf of Mexico, dirt and sediment are picked up along the way, and supposedly over thousands of years, the Mississippi River has deposited fresh water and sediment along the Louisiana coastline. Approximately 500 million tons of sediment are deposited into the Gulf of Mexico by the Mississippi River every year. Now do the math. If uniformitarianism is true, geological processes and rates going on today are the same as they always have been in the past, and if the Earth has been around as long as evolutionists say it has, then the Gulf of Mexico should have long been completely filled with dirt and sediment. That's common sense. It's a simple example. It's an unreasonable assumption. Catastrophism, on the other hand, this is, according to the McGraw-Hill Dictionary of Scientific and Technical Terms, this is the idea that most features in the Earth were produced by the occurrence of sudden, short-lived worldwide events. Now, this approach at interpreting geological phenomena seems much more reasonable, and this is the contention of the creation model. 2 Peter 3, 3-6 says, "Knowing this first, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lusts, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. For this they willfully forget, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of water and in the water, by which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water." So Peter discusses uniformitarianism, the idea that all things continue as they were from the beginning, that the people are going to have a tendency to think that way. And notice he responds to those individuals by pressing the fact that things haven't always moved in the same way since the beginning. Present events are not a key to the past, as uniformitarians suggest. Using uniformitarian thinking when viewing life and the earth is not accurate because it doesn't take into account events which have happened but which don't happen regularly, catastrophic events. Notice what he gives as an example of why uniformitarian thinking isn't accurate. Peter alludes to the greatest catastrophic event ever recorded in history, the global flood of Noah's day. The creation model supports catastrophism as the accurate way to view life and the universe. It doesn't require unreasonable assumptions like uniformitarianism. It accounts for catastrophes that drastically affect any dating schemes attempted by geologists. Now, granted, the implications of the catastrophic approach to interpreting geology, the implications is that there is no way to get an accurate reading of the age of anything that's very old except through divine revelation. But so be it. If that's where the evidence leads, that's where it leads. And it would be unreasonable to accept any other option that is not in harmony with that evidence. Now, on a positive note, some scientists have started seeing the light on this issue. The effects of volcanic eruptions and their mud flows in recent times have cast serious doubt in many minds, many scientific minds, over this idea of uniformitarianism. It's long been believed that the Grand Canyon was the product of millions of years of slow carving by the Colorado River. It's assumed by geologists that the Colorado River has been rolling along as it does now for millions of years, according to uniformitarian principles. But on March 19, 1982, a small eruption at the summit of Mount St. Helens caused a massive mud flow. Within one day, a 20-mile-long, 140-foot-deep canyon was carved, shown here on the screen. Now, this occurrence completely destroys uniformitarianism. If uniformitarianism is true, it should have taken tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years for this canyon to form. It's been called the Little Grand Canyon because it appears to be a 1/40th scale model of the Grand Canyon. Now consider the implications of that. If a canyon that's a 1/40th scale of the Grand Canyon could be carved in just one day, what do you think could happen in 40 days? A catastrophe like the global flood, in which the fountains of the deep were broken up. Another example, for years it's been assumed that the process of petrification is one that takes millions of years to complete. But more and more scientific evidence is coming to light which proves that the rate of petrification can be significantly altered by catastrophic events. For instance, in 2004, five Japanese scientists published their research on rapid petrification in the secular journal Sedimentary Geology. And they were studying mineral-rich, acidic water from the explosion crater of the Tateyama volcano in central Japan, water which runs over the edge of the volcano as a waterfall. Now, some wood had fallen into the path of this mineral-rich water. And the surprising discovery was that the wood had become petrified with silica after only 36 years. As the water flowed over that wood. So they wanted to investigate this phenomenon further. So they attached fresh pieces of wood to wire and put them in the water. After only 7 years, the wood had turned to stone, petrified with silica. Wood petrification had occurred due to the nearby volcanic activity as well, and using a powerful microscope, they found that silica petrification occurs in the same way that the wood petrification occurred in the volcanic ash nearby this volcano. So guess what? Catastrophic events, they change things. You can't assume uniformitarianism. These assumptions, the uniformitarian assumption when considering geologic phenomena, causes major issues. Now the bottom line is, the Little Grand Canyon, the Mississippi River Delta, rapid petrification, these are only three small examples, and there's loads of these. In fact, I was just reading a very recent college geology textbook, and they said right at the beginning, people used to believe in catastrophism and a global flood. And then we believed in uniformitarianism. Now we believe it's both. Well, guess what? We've always believed it was both. We believe catastrophic events happen, and in between uniformity, small changes and so forth happen. We're okay with that. And then there'll be a massive catastrophic event that changes things. So in other words, they're actually once again coming around to believe what we've always said. But the minute you recognize catastrophic events change things in rapid ways, you have to rethink your entire geologic structure of how you're approaching things, your entire geologic model. They haven't come to that point yet. You got to rethink the entire dating scheme that they use. Natural catastrophes seriously affect all dating assumptions. Catastrophes like even local floods, and of course the global flood of Noah's day, but volcanic eruptions, plate tectonics and their effects, especially tectonics that would have been caused by God himself on day three. Have you thought about the implications of what happened on day three? All it says is God caused the dry land to appear. He bunched all that into all the water. Think about the geologic implications of that simple statement. So you've got this dirt underneath this all of this water, and God just bunches it up, what would that have immediately caused geologically? Major mudslides, and the fossilization process would have started immediately. So some plants would have immediately started the petrification process since they were created on day three. Mudslides would have been continuing to go on through day five, so you would have then had birds and fish being petrified immediately. Already on the very first week of our existence, major catastrophic activity. What about, and of course we know even from the flood too, that there's some indication in like Psalm 104, 5 through 9, the creation of valleys and trenches to store much of the water from the flood. There's implications to that that are just mentioned briefly in Scripture. What about miraculous Sodom and Gomorrah-like events? You think that would affect geology? You know, God's miraculous activities in the days of old would certainly have affected dating assumptions, events which could have taken place in many parts of the world that are just not mentioned in the Bible. Do you think the Bible mentions everything God ever did throughout human history? No, the Bible has a specific purpose to tell us certain things, what happened to bring about Jesus. It's telling his story. It's telling a story of God's love for us, leading up to Jesus and how to live this happy life. He doesn't tell us all of the catastrophic things that he did while he's ruling over the nations of men. The Bible is a guidebook to show us how to have happiness and peace and avoid punishment on earth and in heaven, or and after earth. Those goals certainly don't require the Bible to give us some comprehensive listing of everything God might have said or done throughout history to the billions of people that have lived on this earth since the creation. Who knows what God may have done pre and post flood that could have affected the earth's decaying processes? Certainly nobody living today knows that, that's for sure. Now, once the assumption of uniformitarianism is shown to be inaccurate, the entire grounds for dating the Earth as millions of years old falls, and the evidence for an old Earth disappears. Evolutionary dating techniques are built on the assumption of uniformitarianism. According to evolutionists, in order for evolution to be true, the Earth and life have to be very old, billions of years. The truth is, time's not going to help. You sit around staring at a rock for millions of years, and you can be confident it's not going to grow legs and start walking around. I think we can be confident of that. But evolutionists believe they found evidence for the idea that the Earth is old through these techniques. Techniques such as radiometric dating for inorganic materials, carbon dating for organic materials. If these techniques can be shown to be invalid, then the entire basis for dating an old, proving the old Earth idea just crumbles. There are assumptions in these specific dating techniques that prove them to be totally incorrect as gauges of how old the Earth is. In the first session, I discussed the first and second laws of thermodynamics. And the second law indicates that the universe is running down and we're running out of usable energy and matter itself is breaking down. And scientists have discovered that elements on the periodic table break down, they decompose into other elements on this table over time. And the breakdown appears to be at constant rates today. For example, we know that potassium breaks down to argon, uranium to lead, and rubidium into strontium. And the starting element is called the parent element, and the element after the decomposition is known as the daughter element. Scientists are able to measure the rate at which these parent isotopes decay into the daughter isotopes with an amazing degree of accuracy. It's amazing. The problem is that dating techniques like these become more and more inaccurate in telling ages the farther back they try to predict age. In other words, they become less and less likely to predict the actual age of a material the older the object appears to be. And one of the reasons evolutionists know this is that when they try to measure the age of, say, just a rock, and they use different dating techniques on the same rock, they find that different dating techniques almost every time can yield totally different ages for the same rock, differing by even millions of years. And one of the primary reasons for this is the effect of incorrect assumptions in these dating methods that evolutionists use. Assumptions, again, oftentimes have to be made in science in order to have enough information to solve a problem, but the key is to make assumptions that are reasonable. The problem is these dating techniques are not reasonable. Take, for example, the uranium-lead dating technique. Uranium decays into lead over time. What are the assumptions that go into getting an age for a piece of uranium? The first major assumption is that the nuclear decay rate of the elements have been constant throughout history. In other words, nothing occurred in history which could have sped up those decay rates over brief periods of time. Okay? Number two, no daughter element existed in the specimen being measured at the beginning of its decay. In other words, the dating technique assumes that the rock was initially completely composed of the parent element, like uranium in this case. So an assumption about the initial condition of the rock is made. Number three, the parent and daughter isotopes have not been altered by anything except radioactive decay. In other words, the amount of the elements present in a sample haven't been affected by outside forces, outside elements. So for example, a lava flow or some kind of water leaching didn't occur, which could have picked up some of an element from somewhere else and added it to the sample that you're measuring, or taken some of it away, thus corrupting the accuracy of the measurement. Now, common sense should tell you immediately, these are pretty grandiose, presumptuous assumptions, given that nobody's actually ever witnessed the formation of these things. And the older a rock is, the more time there is for those assumptions to have been violated at some point. Now, ironically, the dating techniques only work with a high degree of accuracy for a few thousand years, which is what the creation model would postulate for the age of the earth. But let's go ahead and take a look at these assumptions and think through, are these reasonable, really? Imagine for a moment that you're walking down the sidewalk, and in front of you, in the middle of the walk, is a pail of water, and it's halfway filled. You notice water all around the base of that pail. You look a little closer, and along the base of the bucket, you notice there's a small crack, and it's causing a slow leak. So you decide, you know, I'm going to do an experiment and determine if I can find out when that pail was filled with water and how long it's going to take for that pail to be empty. And so you take out your trusty ruler and you measure how many inches of water in that pail. And you say, okay, it's 6 inches. And so you continue on your walk. And on the way home, 30 minutes later, you stop and you measure that water level again. Okay, now it's 5.5 inches. Okay, so you decide this pail is leaking 0.5 inch every 30 minutes, 1 inch every hour. And you measure the height of that pail, and you find it's 12 inches tall, and you do the math, you feel pretty proud, you're feeling pretty smart and scientific, and you're able to determine that pail must have been filled with water 6.5 hours ago. It'll be empty in another 5.5 hours. There's problems with your experiment. Little did you know that, number one, the pail was initially only 10 inches deep when it was filled 10 hours ago. Number two, the bucket was significantly affected by an outside force. 9 hours ago, a dog came and jumped in that pail and splashed half of that water out, leaving only a quarter of the pail full of water, only 3 inches deep. Now, the force of that dog hitting that bucket caused the leak hole to get bigger, changing the leak rate of that bucket. Then 1 hour ago, the dog's owner came out, filled that pail back to 6.5 inches. You then arrived 30 minutes ago to begin your experiment, at which time the water level was 6 inches due to the leak. Was your experiment a valid experiment? Or did your assumptions corrupt the result? You assumed the pail was completely filled 6.5 hours ago. In actuality, it never was completely filled. It was only 10 inches deep 10 hours ago. Along the way, it was partially refilled. Your experiment was essentially worthless in determining anything because your assumptions were incorrect. Radiometric dating falls victim to these same fallacies. All three of the aforementioned assumptions have been empirically shown to be unreasonable and for the same sort of reasons. For example, concerning that first assumption, this is the equivalent of assuming the crack in the bottom of the water pail always remained the same size, even though the dog's activity actually caused that crack to expand. Now, similarly, is it reasonable to conclude that the nuclear decay rates of the elements have remained constant throughout history? No. And here's one example of how we know that. A team of geologists known as RATE, R-A-T-E, conducted extensive and notable research on this very idea. And these are creationist guys, and they were investigating the contention that nuclear decay rates have not been constant throughout history. The RATE team studied several zircon crystals from a drilling site in New Mexico. Zircons are considered to be some of the oldest minerals on Earth, are very hard and resistant to deterioration. They're also thought to be able to preserve their contents well, making them safer from contamination. Using evolutionary dating techniques, the crystals were found to be 1.5 billion years old. Now, the problem is that the content analysis revealed that large amounts of helium was found to be in the crystals. Now, within zircon crystals, a portion of the zirconium atoms will be replaced by uranium. As uranium-238 decays into its daughter element, lead-206, alpha particles are released that combine with nearby electrons, and helium is formed. And that helium can be found in zircon crystals. By evolutionary dating techniques, the zircons that the RATE team studied revealed billions of years worth of decay from measuring the amount of daughter products in the crystals, but the helium concentration contradicted that. Helium is known to behave as a slippery mineral. Helium atoms are small and are in constant motion as gas particles, so they're hard to contain. They diffuse quickly. Now, here's the problem. If the rocks were as old as the dating techniques suggest, billions of years, there should not have been such high concentrations of helium. It should have long been diffused from the crystals and released into the atmosphere. High concentrations of helium can only be sustained for a few thousand years without significant diffusion. The presence of high concentrations of helium illustrates the fact that at some point or points in the relatively recent past, the nuclear decay rate of uranium had to have been accelerated, producing larger amounts of helium in a short amount of time that have not had time to diffuse yet. So helium concentration in zircons indicates a young age. Evolutionary dating techniques indicate an old age. How can that be rectified, that problem? Well, by understanding that dating errors will inevitably occur if we date those rocks under the assumption that nuclear decay rates have always been constant. If nuclear catastrophes could rapidly speed up decay rates, giving the illusion of old age to a rock, then we know that rocks can be younger than the dating techniques indicate, because the dating techniques are based on that assumption. A global flood in which the fountains of the deep were broken up, surely indicating the releasing of, for example, lava onto the earth, would certainly affect who knows what kind of things in these dating techniques. Concerning the second assumption, no daughter element existed in the specimen at the beginning of its decay. Comparing our water bucket illustration, this assumption is the equivalent to assuming that the bucket of water was initially completely filled with water. Now remember that not only was the bucket not completely filled with water, but at one point water was added back to the bucket, making an assumption about the initial state of the bucket completely worthless. And in the same way, common sense tells us you can't assume that every rock on the earth was initially completely composed of a parent element. How could a person possibly, scientifically, prove such a thing, and how likely would that assumption actually be? Parent-daughter elements from totally different sources could easily merge together in some kind of lava flow to make one rock that has a parent, that has parent and daughter elements at the onset of the rock's decay process and subsequently giving the appearance of age. Again, the creation model would predict that very kind of thing to be occurring. Another factor that the bulk of the scientific community wouldn't even consider is that rocks could have been initially created already comprised of a number of elements rather than all parent elements. Well, if so, then many things would have immediately had the appearance of age the moment they were created. Yeah, but why would God create something with the appearance of age that actually isn't old? Wouldn't that be deceptive? Well, only if you assume that God's motive would have been to create something that looks old solely for the purpose of giving it the appearance of age. But there's a bigger picture here. Every aspect of God's creation serves a purpose in the greater workings of the universe, including, I would say, daughter elements. God might have created daughter elements directly since they were and are an important part of life on earth, not for the purpose of deceiving us, but because of their usefulness. Bottom line, it's quite an assumption to claim that the rock was initially composed only of the parent element. But there are many Bible believers who have bought into the evolutionary propaganda and feel compelled to believe this old age idea. Some believe that these dating techniques do imply an old age for the universe. That in turn causes them to question the account of creation in Genesis 1. But old earth creationists seem to neglect the fact that God had to initially create the universe, the earth, with the appearance of age in order for it to be fit for human beings. Light from stars that are billions of light years away had to already be in place in order for it to be used for what God intended them to be used for humans. Genesis 1:14, for signs, seasons, days, and years. Adam was created with the appearance of age, the appearance of being a grown man from the very first day he was created. He was already able to tend the garden, Genesis 2:15. He was able to understand God's prohibition about the tree of knowledge of good and evil, Genesis 2:16 through 17, so he wasn't some baby. He was able to name the animals, Genesis 2:19 through 20. All of these abilities, in spite of the fact that he had just been created. Trees would have already been grown and bearing fruit. Why? Because Adam and Eve needed it to eat. They would have likely had tree rings in order to be able to support the size of mature trees, because rings help provide strength as trees get older. Daughter elements would have likely been present in rocks because daughter elements serve purposes on the earth other than showing age. So you got to be very careful when making any assumptions about the initial conditions in the decay process. Concerning this third assumption, the item being dated has never been altered by anything except radioactive decay. In other words, this assumption is that we have a closed system, the equivalent of assuming that the pail of water was never affected by anything but that small leak at the bottom of the pail, rather than recognizing that dog jumped in there. Now again, that assumption is very unreasonable. To assume that the rock being dated has not ever been affected by outside forces throughout its entire existence, and you're saying it's been around for millions of years? No water or other substance ever soaked into a specimen and carried off part of an element or added to it, contaminating it? Again, natural catastrophes would certainly affect that assumption, and those are not uncommon today, much less catastrophic events on the scale of the global flood. There's a great book that we sell. It's actually put out by the Institute for Creation Research called The Young Earth. I think I have a few more of those back there, that goes even more into depth in all of this and gives you very modern, recent research on showing the erroneous nature of these assumptions. Be sure to get a copy of that if you haven't. Without these assumptions in place, the earth cannot be dated scientifically, and that bothers a lot of scientists. So they ignore the issues with those assumptions and do the best they can. But these assumptions totally destroy any attempt to date materials that are very old because those assumptions cannot logically hold. It's simply unscientific to ignore the issues here. The truth is there has been such catastrophic events over the years that make it impossible to use those techniques to date the earth. And the only way to get an age for the earth is through divine revelation. Now, that said, geology through the lenses of the creation model is a fascinating study, and it's in harmony with the evidence. I actually got to go with Dr. Kurt Wise, a paleontologist, graduated from Harvard, that's a young earth guy, up to Wyoming in June and study decisive evidence for the flood up there. Talk about it in this discovery issue that came out this month. We've got some more of those back there if you're interested in reading about that. Much could be done if geologists would look at the evidence and interpret it in light of biblical statements. The creation model accounts for catastrophes like the global flood and Sodom-like events, as well as the geological implications of God's statements in Genesis 1, where again the earth is said to have been initially covered with water. And then in verse 9, God says on day 3, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, let the dry land appear." Again, one verse, major geologic implications. The geological implications of a statement like that are profound. Recall this chart from previous sessions. It highlights these fundamental planks of evolutionary theory and the opposing stance that the creation model takes. If any one of those planks can be shown to be untrue, the entire model collapses. And yet we found in previous sessions that the first five of those planks are contradicted time and again by the actual scientific evidence. The laws of science and the alleged evidence for evolution all fail to prove evolution. Creation model is found to be in harmony with the evidence on all accounts. We've looked at the principle of uniformitarianism now, found it to be inadequate in explaining what we see in the geologic strata. Catastrophism fits the evidence better, a theory that we champion as creationists. We've looked at this concept of deep time, the proposition that the universe is extremely old and therefore could even allow for evolutionary theory to happen. The evidence that is put forth to attempt to prove that idea comes from these dating techniques, which we see are flawed at a fundamental level based on their assumptions. Scientific evidence is available which indicates the universe is actually relatively young, a proposition in harmony with the creation model. All of that alleged evidence for evolution, when you really dig into it, you find out it doesn't help them at all. Naturalism is unscientific. It's left irrational. It doesn't have any conclusive legitimate evidence for it. The creation model, on the other hand, has no problem with the evidence. Let me leave you with one quote. American physicist George Greenstein amazingly conceded, "As we survey all the evidence, the thought insistently arises that some supernatural agency, or rather agency, must be involved. Is it possible that suddenly, without intending to, we've stumbled upon scientific proof of the existence of a supreme being? Was it God who stepped in and so providentially crafted the cosmos for our benefit?" He doesn't accept that, but I believe the evidence is conclusive. Thank you for your attention.